You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Welcome to the most controversial parenting teaching in 2025. We're going to talk about gender. Just kidding. It's not. I don't think this is going to be all that controversial. We are mainly just going to be talking about the general idea of there being differences between boys and girls. And I think even today, most people acknowledge that that is the case. So we're going to be understanding the differences between parenting boys versus girls. Just briefly about me, my husband Luke and I have three kids. We have two boys and a girl. So that is the extent of my qualifications to teach on this. I haven't studied this in any kind of formal setting. But I have read a number of books on this in preparation. So my goal is just to kind of impart to you some of the stuff I've read and just start the ball rolling with thinking about this topic. I wanted to start by telling you a little bit about my dog. Here he is, very cute. That's in his better days. He's very near the end right now. This is my dog. His name is Mud, and he's a mutt. So when we got him, he was a puppy, and you know when you get a mutt, they just kind of make up what they think he is. So they told us he was a mastiff mix. He was kind of looked like a mastiff. If you know about mastiffs, they're extra large dogs. They're huge. They're real wrinkly. They're kind of drooly, and they're known for being guard dogs. Our dog to this day has never once barked at someone at the front door. He barks at other things, but not in any kind of guarding capacity. He's big, but he's not extra large. He's definitely not a mastiff. Mastiffs also are kind of known for being lazy. And from very early on, it was clear that this dog is not lazy. In fact, when he was, you know, young, he was extremely destructive because he had so much energy. And we knew that if we left the house and he was there for any amount of time, that he was going to destroy something. And so we learned really early on, this dog needs a lot of exercise. So I had to start taking him running. The other thing we learned is that he was some sort of hunting dog. This is a picture of him with a squirrel in his mouth, which is sad for the squirrel, but very happy for the dog. He wanted to chase and hunt things all the time. And so for us and our kids, we learned if you're on a walk with this dog, you have to brace yourself if a squirrel runs out in front of you, because there is no training that's going to teach him to not chase that squirrel. We also learned if there's a sketchy daytime raccoon stumbling in a backyard, we can't let the dog out because he will get it. Unfortunately, we learned at one point that he will, in fact, bring a dead groundhog into the house and put it in our daughter's stuffed animal pile. Why am I telling you all this? Because I think this relates to our goal today. Our goal is to identify and understand the different tendencies and motivations between boys and girls in order to best guide them into adulthood. And so, you know, much like understanding my dog's breed, it is helpful for us to understand how our kids are wired so that we know how to engage with them, we know what motivates them, we know what they like to do, and so that is our goal. Our goal is not to define black and white gender expectations. And so what I mean by that is that we all know that all boys don't like trucks and tackle football, right? And all girls don't like playing with Barbies and doing makeup. That we are speaking in generalizations and tendencies, and we understand that not everyone is going to fit into a nice, neat gender box. We're also not assigning morality to gendered behaviors, meaning, you know, that a boy should or shouldn't like trucks and football. My references this morning are pretty much exclusively Dr. Leonard Sachs. That is mainly just because he is one of the few authors who has written books both on boys and girls. He's also written this book, Why Gender Matters. So for simplicity's sake, it was easier for me to just kind of look at these books. I also like him. He's pretty fair and measured when he's talking about this stuff. He seems to have a high view of both boys and girls. Yeah, I don't agree with 100% of what he says. I've never read a parenting book that I agree with 100%. But I think that he's pretty good overall. one of the endearing things about him is he talks about atypical boys and girls, and he says that he was an atypical boy, and his favorite activity was macrame when he was little. So I really like that about him. Okay, so this is a huge topic. We could probably do part two and part three of this. We're just going to look at three main differences this morning: restlessness, risk-taking, and aggression. So for each one of these main differences, we're just going to look at what it looks like for boys and girls, and then I have a common parenting mistake and a tip for each one of these. So even though we're only looking at three differences, I still kind of feel like it's a lot of information. So I would encourage you to just kind of pick one or two slides that you're going to really try to take in. Okay, restlessness. Little boys, this is their calling card, right? That they have the drive to move. Little boys are known for how wild and energetic they are. From a very early age, typically, you know, around the age of two, you start noticing, whoo, this boy has a lot of energy, endless energy. Little boys also are prone to impulsivity. So this means if you're a boy mom, that typically you're the embarrassed mom at playgroup because your boy is the one that's punching people when he's not getting the truck that he wants, right? That they have self-control issues more so than little girls do. They also have a low tolerance for sitting still. This is still the case for two of my boys. And then all this kind of combines to for little boys to often struggle with school expectations. And so our common mistake here is talking or disciplining the energy out of boys. As I was thinking about this, I was reminded of this really difficult summer day a couple years ago. I think we've all had those days, right, where the kids are just going bananas. And my kids were fighting, the boys were breaking stuff, bouncing off the walls. I think I had been hit like three times in the face by some, like a football or a soccer ball, which is my Achilles heel, really. Just a couple days ago, I got hit in the face with a snowball and did not handle it well. So I tell the boys, go outside. And soon one of them comes in with a bleeding head because the other one accidentally hit him in the head with a rock. And I remember this day clearly because at one point I went outside and I found a dog dish filled to the brim with little boy urine. And I was just like losing my mind. But this day we had plans to go meet a friend. So I get everybody in the car and we go meet my friend. And we're doing the like, what's up? How's it going? What have you guys been doing thing? And she's like, how's it going? And I'm like, fine. You know, I'm losing my mind. How's it going with you? What have you guys been up to? And she's like, I don't know. It's been kind of like a boring day. Me and my girls have been laying on the couch reading books all day. And that was not what I needed to hear at all. Because as a boy mom, there's this nagging thought, something is wrong with these boys, right? Why does someone climb a refrigerator? And you just want to say, why are you doing this? One of my boys is going through a phase where he just stands there and throws something across the room. And I'm always saying, why are you doing that? He doesn't know, right? So when we compare our boys to our friends' little girls that are laying on the couch all day, we think something is not right. But the truth is, they're not wired the same, right? That we shouldn't be trying to force them to behave like these little girls. We can't reason with them to calm down. And so my tip here is that we need to plan for exercise. These boys are hunting dogs. They need to exercise. They need an outlet for all that energy, especially the boys that are sitting in school all day, that have to practice that self-control and sit still. They're not allowed to climb on their desks. So when they get home, as parents, we should plan and strategize for how can we help them get that energy out. I think organized sports is excellent for this. I'm very pro organized sports. It's a wonderful thing, and it's built into the week often, and it's a good way for kids to get their energy out. Okay, little girls. Little girls do not have the drive to move, typically, generally speaking, but they have what we're going to call an inner restlessness. They have this inner drive to define themselves by what they do. And so part of this often is this drive to overachieve, to appear to be the good girl or the perfect girl or the best girl. Part of this might be due in part to girls' higher concern for authority. Sachs points out that little boys often are less motivated by pleasing their teacher or pleasing their parents, and that little girls often are more motivated by pleasing their teacher or pleasing their parents. We have examples of this in movies. Hermione Granger is a good example, right? That she is, all of her energy is put towards being the top of their class and being the perfect girl, being looked as always having the answer, always having it together. She doesn't want to break the rules either. One of my favorite movies, Mean Girls, is a different look at a similar thing, where the main characters, these popular girls, all their energy in life is about building their identity and how people view them, right? That they have the perfect clothes, they say the perfect things, they are affiliated with the popular boys or dating the most popular boys. And so all their energy is put towards this. I think it's worth noting that Sachs points out that this issue of inner restlessness is one of the driving factors that attracts girls to and causes the most damage when they are obsessed with social media. That this is the drive towards social media because social media is this venue where they can kind of shape and control how people view them. And so they become obsessed with it. He quotes this author, Sarah Reimer, who wrote an article on this, and it says, "These girls' quest for the perfect resume is conflicting with their search for a sense of who they really are. Reimer found girls by the dozen are high-achieving, ambitious, and confident. Girls who do everything, varsity sports, student government, theater, community service, but being an amazing girl often doesn't feel like enough these days when you're competing with all the other amazing girls around the country who are applying to the same colleges that you've been encouraged to aspire to practically all your life. There's something about the lives these girls lead, their jam-packed schedules, the amped-up multitasking, the focus on a narrow group of the nation's most selective colleges that speaks of a profound anxiety." This article is called "For Girls, It's Be Yourself and Be Perfect Too." I think as women, we can probably relate to this, that there is a drive to be viewed as the best or the perfect, the most perfect, or having it all together. And if we can't relate to this, we probably know a handful of girls that this describes probably perfectly. And so it's destructive, right? Because the people that we know that are obsessed in this way, often the one thing that they're obsessed about or defining themselves through, when that thing crumbles, their life kind of falls apart. Sachs references this phrase, anorexia of the soul, I think in both his Why Gender Matters book as well as the Girls on the Edge book. And it's a phrase that he says he got from another parent, but he defines it this way. He says, anorexia of the soul is an obsessive search for an authentic sense of self. For some girls, morphing into a frantic and ultimately self-destructive perfectionism. In other girls, it can become a relentless focus on sports or thinness or beauty. So earlier I said I feel like Sachs is fair, that he has pretty equal view on girls and boys. But I have to say, when I read this, something about it didn't sit right with me. The title, Anorexia of the Soul, I don't know. But also the definition, this obsessive search for an authentic sense of self. You know, to me, that's a humanity problem. That's not a gendered problem. Isn't it true that both boys and girls have this longing to know, who am I really? Why am I valuable? And so, I don't know, I question this. And I feel like this is one of the draws to Christianity, that kind of the whole Bible is about this issue, this fact that we feel this longing, this desire to know who we are. We feel like there's something missing. And so the Bible points to Jesus as being that thing that's missing, the cause of the anorexia of the soul, that we are missing this relationship with God, and it's only through Jesus that we can have that longing fulfilled. I love, too, how the Bible illustrates this. often it uses this illustration of an insatiable thirst or unquenchable thirst or an insatiable hunger, right? John 6 talks about this, where it says, Jesus declared, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. Psalm 63, 1 and 5 say, O God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you, as in a dry and weary land where there is no water. It goes on to say, because of your love, my soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich food, and my mouth will praise you with joyful lips. Yeah, I love this picture that there is this tendency to seek out things to kind of fulfill this longing, but the Bible says there's only one thing that's actually going to satisfy us. And so I do feel like this is both a boy and girl issue, this longing to know who I am, why I'm valuable, and the Bible has an answer for it. With that being said, he's not totally wrong, right? These symptoms of the obsessing over how people see me and wanting to have this one relationship and putting all of our energy into it, or wanting to be viewed as, you know, the smartest girl in the class and going to Yale, I think that is gendered a bit, that often is a girl problem. And so for our common mistake, I have here that our mistake is perpetuating a one-dimensional identity. Sachs points this out, that early on in our children's lives, that we kind of get to steer their lives. And this is tricky because one part of having kids that's exciting and fun is figuring out who they are, what they like, what they're into, what they're good at. And so, you know, you see that your daughter loves gymnastics and she's really good at it, you want to get her into that. And he says, you know, I don't think he says there's anything wrong with that, but he says early on, it's to their benefit to expose them to multiple things, right? That you can be a gymnast, you can also try out theater, and you can have all these different groups of friends and see that you are not just one thing. I think, you know, for us as parents, part of this means that we want to kind of fan the flames and emphasize their character as well, that you are not just a good gymnast, but you are also kind and you're gifted in these other ways as well. Our tip here is that as parents, we can and should nurture their soul, right? And so we're talking about this anorexia of the soul, that from early on, we can teach them what the Bible has to say about why they are valuable and who they are, that it's not just about these things that you do, but the fact that God has designed you real specifically and that you're valuable because God loves you. I think it's also important for us as mothers to realize a big part of this is modeling. And so I think most of us would probably agree with the fact that we still feel this drive, you know, to compare ourselves to other people and to, you know, feel like we've got to have it all together. And so one of our jobs is to model that we have access to peace. We know what it looks like to be okay with not being the perfect one. Okay, so that's our first one, restlessness. Second one is risk-taking. As a mom of boys, this is probably the most stressful part of having boys, right? The constant risks. And these snow days have really accentuated that, right? My kids, you know, normal sledding is not for anyone, apparently. Boys have to stand and sled. One of my kids was sledding with one foot in each sled going down and went off a like 4-foot wall. Boys take more risks than girls. I think most of us know this. I think one thing that's helpful in understanding is that risky behavior is pleasurable for boys, that it releases pleasurable chemicals. This stands in opposition to risky behavior being stressful for most girls. What a terrible combination. The thing that stresses us out the most as mothers gives our boys almost, you know, the most pleasure in their life. Another important thing, boys tend to overestimate their abilities while underestimating their limitation. So, you know, part of this is good. To have a little bit of extra confidence is good, but it also means little boys are not the best risk analysis people, And then most importantly, I think for both boys and girls, risks are developmentally necessary. And so our common mistake here is removing all risk-taking opportunities. So that's the temptation, right? As moms, it's so stressful. I don't want to see it. You can't do it. I don't want you to get hurt. You're not allowed to do it. But risk is extremely valuable. In Jonathan Haidt's book, Anxious Generation, he has a whole chapter devoted to this, explaining the value of risk. And he does it by explaining this concept of anti-fragility. In this chapter, he talks about the fact that there are some things in life that are fragile, and there are some things in life that are anti-fragile. I'm missing part of that slide. A wine glass is an example. A wine glass is a fragile item. If it falls off and endures some stress, it's going to break. An oak tree, on the other hand, actually needs stress in order to grow strong and thrive, right? That an oak tree needs to be planted outside to be exposed to the elements so that it signals to the roots to go down deep and to be strong. Another example of this is the human immune system. We know that the immune system does not do well in a bubble, that it needs exposed to stressors in order to grow into this robust immune system. And so he says that children also are anti-fragile, that they need stress and risk in order to grow up into stable adults. His tip and emphasis in his chapter is that we as parents should implement more unsupervised outdoor play. So there's age-appropriate things that we need to consider here. But, you know, this is kind of pushing against our culture's swing in being overprotective. Here's what he says about it. He says, unsupervised outdoor play teaches children to handle risks and challenges of many kinds. By building physical, psychological, and social competence, it gives kids confidence that they can face new situations and is an inoculation against anxiety. There are multiple parenting books that make the same point. Dr. Wendy Mogul wrote a book called Blessing of a Skinny Knee that's kind of all about this. Lenore Skenazy in her book Free Range Parenting, that's kind of the underlying thesis of her book, that kids need to be out on their own. They need to face problems and failure in order to grow up to be adults, to be able to know I actually can endure these difficult situations that I'm facing on my own. I think it's important for us as moms too, you know, we're stressed by these little boys, but we need to think about their future. They're not good at analyzing risks. We want them to fail as much as possible when they're little so that when they're teenagers and in college and their friends want them to drive drunk or jump from building rooftops or whatever they're going to do, they're going to know, oh, I've crashed before and I've fallen before. I probably shouldn't do this. I tried jumping once when I was little and I couldn't get that far, right? We want them to have failure so that they know when they're older, I probably can't do this. Okay, little girls, as I said, take less risk than boys. It's stressful. It's also important to note that failure is more discouraging often for girls than it is for boys. That they are more at risk of saying, I'm never taking that risk again, than little boys are. Again, risks are developmentally necessary, and girls underestimate their abilities and overestimate their limitations. So our common mistake here would be enjoying the peace and allowing them to not take risks. Again, we want to take a proactive approach and encourage them to take risks. In Sachs's book, he talks about this idea of dare training, which is kind of an organized way of implementing risks into girls' lives. And I have a quote here about dare training, but it mentions a mouse in a bathtub. And what he's mentioning is this study that they did where they had two groups of mice, and one group of mice had this little like mouse playground, and they could climb little trees and burrow through tunnels and climb walls and stuff. And the other group of mice were held tight and overprotected. They weren't able to run around and experience this little playground. And unfortunately, at the end of the study, they dropped the mice into a bathtub. And they make the point that mice can swim a little bit. But the overprotected mice took like two paddles and then began to sink, and they saved them. The mice with the playground showed far more resiliency. They swam for way more than the overprotected mice. And this is kind of the point, especially for our girls, right? We don't want our boys to be wild and reckless as adults, but we want our girls to be strong and confident, right? Think about the things in life that are risky. You know, confronting a friend, standing up for things that you believe in when everybody else wants you to bend on something, saying no to a boyfriend. You know, there are so many things in life that are risky. The more we can develop this in our daughters' lives, the stronger they're going to be as adults. Here's the quote. If a girl takes a risk and fails, she may end up being more risk-averse, not less. The feeling of weakness and inability and the tendency to low self-esteem are so integrated into girls' thinking that this training can be counterproductive if we do not know exactly what we're doing. Start with something the girls know they can do, then gradually let them build up that wall, stretch their abilities to the limit. Don't throw the mouse in the bathtub until it's had plenty of experience climbing the little trees and squiggling through tunnels. And when the girls fail and they fall, you have to be there to catch them, dust them off, encourage them to try again. I don't love this quote because he makes the point, if you don't know exactly what you're doing, you're going to be worse off. No one knows exactly what they're doing in parenting. I don't think we're ever going to know exactly what we're doing. I think the point I want to take away from that quote is we need to be intentional about it and, you know, start it from an early age. We have to encourage them. Try climbing this tree. These are words you never have to say to your son, right? Try climbing this tree. You know, let's try and learn how to ride a bike. You're going to be okay. And then we have to be a little bit more careful with them when they do fail. They emphasize in this DARE training that when they do it, they try to do it away from boys, just so that the boys don't say anything or discourage them. Sachs is real big on separating genders, especially in education, too. Okay, last one here, aggression. Boys fight a lot, 20 times more than girls. So this is taken from a researcher who spent all this time observing playground activity. Boys are drawn to weapons, violence, and fighting. Here's a quote about this. Boys as young as 2 years of age, given a choice between violent fairy tales and warm and fuzzy fairy tales, usually choose the violent stories. Girls as young as 2 years of age consistently choose the warm and fuzzy stories. In another study, psychologists found that 5- and 7-year-old girls who prefer violent stories are more likely to have significant behavior problems than girls who prefer warm, nurturing stories. However, among boys, preference for violent stories is not an indicator of underlying psychiatric problems. A preference for violent stories seems to be normal for 5- to 7-year-old boys, while the same preference in 5- to 7-year-old girls suggests a psychiatric disorder. Okay, not trying to diagnose anybody's little girl here. The point I want to take away from this quote is, especially for moms, this draw to violence and weaponry and killing and, you know, it is always a red flag in our mind. What he's saying is it's normal. It's okay. It's just so different from us. Many of us cannot compute. Why do you always want to smash something? Why are you so attracted to this violent show? And we always feel like, is he going to be a murderer? I don't know. And the point is, it's normal. We are wired very differently in this way. I think it's important for us to note aggression in boys build status and relationship. So this is a big part of boy culture, the rough and tumble play, even the negative relating. My boys are in this phase big time right now, where it's just constant trash talking each other, you know, poking fun. This is a big part of boy culture. Rough and tumble play is developmentally important. This also is important, you know, because we, in our mind, this thing with violence and aggression is a red flag, there is a tendency to say, we're just not going to do it. No weapons. You're not wrestling. We don't need to fight. We're going to remove that. Here's what Sachs says about that. It is often thought if you prevent kids from playing aggressive games, then kids will be less aggressive. In fact, there's no evidence that preventing kids from acting out their aggression in healthy ways will diminish or eliminate their aggressive impulses. Instead, prohibiting these activities may actually increase the likelihood that the suppressed aggression will manifest itself in less healthy ways. Okay. I'm not trying to say there is a black and white answer to this problem, but what I am saying is as women, because we are not wired this way, we might need to change our perspective. There might be part of this that we just don't totally understand. And he's saying that, in fact, there's a lot of benefit to them being able to play in this way with one another. And so my common mistake for us here is banning all aggressive play and relating. I feel like over the last couple years, I started to have my eyes open to this in a big way. It has never made sense to me. It's a lot for me, the constant fighting and wrestling and stuff like that. But one of our boys got into wrestling. And I have always worked with athletes. I've been exposed to a lot of sports. I've worked with rugby players and wrestlers and football players. So when we started doing wrestling, I kind of felt like I know what I'm getting into. The first wrestling meet we went to, I was shocked. I kind of expected, you know, you'll go into this and it's going to be a little bit of a masculine thing, right? There's going to be a bunch of dads hyping up their sons and, you know, the boys are going to be real serious and focused. We went into this gym, and this is like a league where the kids are like anywhere from 5 years old to 13. And you go into this high school, and it's hundreds of little boys in singlets. Everywhere you looked, someone was crying, like weeping, like a little baby. They're crying everywhere. And it wasn't because they were hurt. It was because they were frustrated. And, you know, they knew the rules of the game. They're being pinned, okay, which is very, very frustrating. They're using every ounce of energy in their body to not get pinned. They're failing publicly, which is a big reason I like organized sports. So they're failing publicly, and they're getting pinned, and they're mad, and they're frustrated, but they're not allowed to hit, and they're not allowed to quit. And so this thing, this self-control with their body is being developed at an early age. And I realized, oh my God, this is what I want for my boys. Because as a mom, when you see your kid not exercising self-control, we always think, are you going to beat your wife one day? You're not supposed to say it, but you do think it. That's the fear. We want to raise a man who has self-control and that can experience frustration without trying to hurt someone. And so I realized, oh my gosh, that's what they're learning in this. They're frustrated more than they've ever been, but they're not allowed to hit and they're not allowed to quit. You know, and think about being married and how when you are in a fight with your spouse, you are so frustrated, but you don't want to quit and you don't want your husband to hit, right? And so I realized, you know, there's something to these combat sports that's valuable. I'm not saying everybody needs to put their kid in that, but I am saying there's value in what's being learned. And so my tip here for aggression is this is an area we can really lean on our husbands. It's something that a lot of us don't understand totally. And for me, I'm regularly like, is that normal? You know, this seems problematic. And my husband's like, I think it's fine. It's normal. And the other thing is, at the end of the day, I've already confessed I don't like getting hit in the face. When everybody wants to wrestle, it's really nice to have my husband take over that job because I have a real strong stance on I don't wrestle or do boxing at the end of the day. Okay, aggression. As we know, girls are seldomly overtly aggressive. They're not going to get into physical fights typically. Acts of aggression are in a more covert form. We're going to call this alternative aggression. Physical aggression in girl world lowers status and it destroys relationships. One of the points that Sachs makes in his books is that even physical aggression with boys often doesn't end relationships, but physical aggression and alternative aggression in girls will often do major damage in relationships. Girls tend to be more aware of relational subtleties and have higher emotional intelligence. One of the studies he cites in his book I thought was super interesting, where they took all these newborn babies. Well, I don't know if they were newborn. They were young babies, and they had them laying in a crib. And the babies had the option to stare at a moving mobile or a woman's smiling face. And the girls were like 2 or 4 times more likely to stare at the woman's face. I know that's the case in my house, where my daughter is keyed in to studying someone's emotions. And as we know, as adult women, often our husbands don't have that on their radar, right? When you say, "Poof, did you see Rebecca? Something was up with her," and they're like, "What are you talking about?" Right? Our daughters have been and will be studying people's emotions and faces, and this is how their aggression comes out. It's in the psychological warfare, right? They do these subtle acts of aggression. Sachs, in his book, points out that as parents, it's typical that if our boy comes home from school with a bloody lip and says, "I got into a fight after school," that we, you know, sound all the alarms. We go and we talk to the kid's parents. We're concerned. But when our daughter comes home and says, "You know, Lisa gave me a dirty look during spelling, and then some people didn't sit with me at lunch," we're like, "I'm sure you're making that up. You know, you're fine." We dismiss this as drama, right? She's just being dramatic. He says it's almost always true. They see these little subtleties that are happening in school, and they're perceiving it and understanding, "I'm being punished." And so as parents, our job is to have an early emphasis on healthy conflict resolution and to not dismiss this stuff, to come alongside our daughter and to help her walk her through how to handle this, because these kinds of aggressions can be damaging and really difficult for girls. Okay, that's our three differences: restlessness, risk-taking, and aggression. You know, now that we're at the end, some of you might be a little disappointed that we didn't really have a black and white answer for, do we put our son in tackle football? When is it okay for little girls to wear makeup? But I wanted to end with this verse. In Ephesians 2:10, it says, "For we are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do." This is one of my favorite concepts that's put forth in the New Testament, that each one of us is designed very uniquely, very, very special by God, that he has a plan for our lives. And so I think when we are thinking about this stuff with our children, it's the same way, that we should view them as very unique and special, that God has wired them a specific way, and it's our job as parents to try and help figure out, you know, how are you wired, and how can we kind of fan the flame and encourage you towards what God has for you. Okay, that's all I have.